The Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan, excused. Vice Chair Smith.
Here.
Ranking Member Valdez. Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Bracy Davis.
Here.
Campbell. Duggan.
Here.
Fabricio.
Here.
Gottlieb. Jacques.
Here.
Saroy. Snyder.
Here.
Stark.
Here.
Waldron.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everybody to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. Please ensure that your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or placed on silent mode. I'd like to also ask everyone speaking before the subcommittee to please fill out an appearance card if you haven't already done so and they're available from the staff. I'd just like to say again, good afternoon. I'm filling in again for Chair Brannon, who's out for some minor medical treatment. We'll see him again shortly. We hope the chairman comes back upright and pain-free. Today we'll be taking up hearing one bill, our first bill, and a presentation from the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice and the Florida Department of Corrections to update us on some various issues pertaining to their respective departments. Let us begin today's meetings by taking up our lone member bill of the day. All right. And we are hearing House Bill 83, Trust Funds Recreation State Operated Institution Inmate Welfare Trust Fund, from Representative Lopez. You are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Good afternoon, Vice Chairman, Ranking Member Valdez, and members of the committee. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. This is a reauthorization bill. This legislation recreates what is known as the State Inmate Welfare Trust Fund in the statute and extends the sunset date from July 1st of 2024 to July 1st of 2028. The Inmate Welfare Trust Fund is replenished with revenue generating sources within the Department of Corrections. These funds are utilized to enhance education, programming, wellness, and living conditions for the inmates within custody of the department. Each of these efforts improves safety within our correctional institutions and advances rehabilitative efforts. Last session, thanks to our vice chairman, the legislature made a historic increase to the department's spending authority within the inmate trust fund. The amount that our vice chairman was able to secure was $32 million, when in the past they've only had $2.5 million. The department has produced amazing results with these funds. So the impact of this bill is simply to extend it past its current sunset date, and that is the bill, Mr. Vice Chairman.
All right, thank you very much. I see no amendments. Questions? Do we have questions about House Bill 83? Representative Gottlieb, happy birthday, and you are recognized.
Thank you, sir. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So I had some questions. I think we've seen the bill before, and something that I wasn't certain about was whether or not the Department of Corrections has any revenue share as to where the, because I think the money's funded through inmate phone calls, so on and so forth. Is that correct?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Yes, Representative Gottlieb, it is funded through phone calls and some other inmate programs such as the canteen, et cetera.
Follow-up. So my question is, do you know if DOC shares in any of that revenue?
You're recognized.
It does not. Those funds, as allocated by the appropriations last year, was strictly for education funding and also for equipment in the classrooms. But it does pay a fee to the general revenue, because all trust funds have a very small piece that have to be allocated to the general revenue.
Final follow-up.
Okay, that was my next question, was about, and I think there's something about $2.5 million, is that correct, that goes to general revenue, or when it reaches that threshold? I was going to ask, why is that, and how much money goes?
Thank you. I do not know the exact amount. I'm sure DOC is here to make a presentation, so you may want to check with them during their presentation, but I don't know the exact amount that goes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No other questions? Public testimony? Ranking Member Valdez with a question. You're recognized.
You know that that's a normal, no. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And Representative Lopez, thank you for bringing this bill to us. I guess my question is, you know, we all know that the canteen prices has gone, gosh, exponentially expensive. And considering that that the families are investing in these measures and communication, things of that nature, could there be a possibility that we could potentially exceed in revenue the $32 million? And if we do, what then happens to the money that is above and beyond the $32 million?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the appropriations from last year was $32 million. If, in fact, the fund gets to $35 million, those excessive funds would not go into this program. Based on the appropriations, it would move into general revenue.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess maybe that might be something that we may need to address in a future bill, and maybe not necessarily. I guess my question is, would a friendly amendment to this particular measure, to this particular bill that you're presenting, would it be acceptable, or is it something specific with trust funds that we must do?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So I would always accept a friendly amendment. However, the statute says that you, for reauthorizations, they must stand alone and just reauthorize. And so that's what this bill is doing, strictly reauthorizing it to 2028.
Thank you, Representative Lopez.
Thank you.
All right, no other questions. Public testimony, I think we have one, two. Jake Felder from Department of Corrections, waving in support. And Nathan Sherrod, Horizon Communications Corporation, waving in support. Excellent, excellent. We have one other person handing the, there we go. And you're welcome to start heading up. No, she's sitting back down.
Thank you, Loretta.
Okay. All right. And that's not on this bill. All right. Okay, good. Representative Lopez, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Debate. Representative Beltran, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Rep. Lopez, for your bill. I'm going to support the bill, but I did want to make some comments about, you know, how we're raising these revenues and who the costs are falling upon, and how that should be managed. I get some correspondence from time to time. It's either emails to my legislative office, or sometimes people will comment or tweet at me or tag me on Facebook and Twitter, and they're concerned about the costs of inmate phone calls, and we had a discussion about that. And I understand some of the cost of the inmate phone calls is attributable to the monitoring costs, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that. I think certainly the government gets valuable information by monitoring the calls. In my previous life as a criminal defense attorney, it was very frustrating because they were causing me to spend time listening to those calls to see if my client incriminated themselves. I told them, stop getting on the calls, they're expensive, number one. Number two, you're incriminating yourself. That's why they're giving me the calls in discovery, then I have to listen to them. But still, the calls are very expensive. If we're defraying monitoring costs, that's one thing. But I don't think we should be making money off of the calls, even if we're using those profits for a good purpose. And perhaps with the canteen items as well. So that's probably another policy discussion for another day. But the calls, you know, it's not 30 years ago when long distance was an expensive thing. Everyone on their cell phone has unlimited long distance in the United States. And the call cost did seem a little expensive to me when I looked into it. So I didn't want to, you know, vote on this without kind of offering that up or to perhaps be addressed at another time. Thank you.
Any other members in debate? Ranking Member Valdez, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I, too, agree with Representative Beltran. I think that we need to be a little bit cognizant about how much our families of incarcerated constituents are having to invest just to keep in contact with their loved one, as well as providing, well, some relief in canteen while they are serving their punishment to society. And I think that we are incarcerating families, and we continue to hurt these families and not just the individual that is that caused the infraction or broke the law. So I really hope that we can dive into a little bit deeper to make things a little bit more equitable. I don't want these families to have to be supporting the Department of Corrections on their backs when, you know, we as a state is responsible to provide those services and that maintenance of these individuals that are under our care. I mean, so anytime that something bad happens in a prison, guess who's responsible? This body, because we allow it. So there's a lot of things that we allow that we should not. And we're not helping to correct any behaviors by continuing to punish families for one of their loved ones, paying their debt to society for whatever reason that they're in there for. So I hope that our committee will address this a little bit more and have those courageous conversations around this issue. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other members wishing to debate, Representative Lopez, you are recognized to close on House Bill 83.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I will just address very quickly the two comments that were made. So there have been additional vendors entering into the market, and it is expected that rates will begin to decrease. There will be a procurement when the current contract ends in about 2 years. So hopefully we will see a reduction in those rates. I also wanted to point out that last year the legislature funded a free phone call program. It's a small pilot that allows those who have good behavior to have free phone calls. And that's currently it's currently in effect. So hopefully we will be able to use some of this as motivation for good behavior as well, and potentially in the future, we hope that the rates will in fact decrease. So I welcome those comments around the welfare trust fund. That is the bill.
Thank you. I'd like to remind members to please use their microphone. And Representative Lopez, having closed on the bill, Rosa, will you please call the roll?
Chair Brannon, Vice Chair Smith.
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez.
Yes.
Representatives Beltran.
Yes.
Gracie Davis.
Yes.
Campbell.
Yes.
Duggan.
Yes.
Fabricio.
Yes.
Gottlieb.
Yes.
Jacques.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Stark.
Yes.
Waldron.
Yes.
13 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. And by your vote, we'll show that bill, House Bill 83, our first bill, favorably.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Members, as you may recall from last session, the Department of Juvenile Justice was authorized and appropriated funding to establish Florida Scholars Academy in order to provide and deliver educational opportunities to students serving in residential commitment programs within the department. The department recently executed a contract for delivery of those services. Here today to provide us with an update and establishment and implementation of Florida Scholars Academy is Secretary Eric Hall. Mr. Secretary, you are recognized. Mr. Secretary, you're a little bit closer to the mic, or bring it up.
I didn't have it on, I'm sorry.
ON, ONF is what you always get you, yeah.
So I'll start again by saying, thank you, Chair Smith, Ranking Member Valdez, members of the committee. It's always a pleasure to be here with you and to talk about the work that we're doing at the department. And today to focus in, you know, more specifically to the work that we're doing with the Florida Scholars Academy. You know, I'll start by, you know, not only thanking this body, but I want to thank specifically Representative Jacques, Representative Valdez for co-sponsoring that really led to the creation of this new unified school system. And we are definitely working, you know, very quickly to bring this into full fruition to start July 1 of 2024. So this is our startup year, putting all the infrastructure and things in place. You know, many of you have heard me talk about this before, and I know sometimes it might sound a little bit redundant, but I think most of you know my background and my commitment to education. And as a former educator and as someone who, you know, really thinks that our best public safety strategy is around ensuring a high-quality education for our youth across our full continuum and making sure that kids are getting a high-quality education, even at the early ages of early learning with things like BPK and the other opportunities available here in our state. But as we look specifically in this case with the Florida Scholars Academy, this is really our first step into creating for the first time ever a unified school system for our residential programs here in the state of Florida. And it's really around this central tenet in the mission, which is about how do we make sure that we're providing a free and appropriate education, but it's high quality. We want to make sure that we're accelerating outcomes for the youth that we serve. Many of the young people that make their way into our residential facilities are coming in behind in reading, behind in math, behind in the number of credits that put them on track for graduating high school, and have a number of other challenges that can be, you know, related to special educational needs that need to be provided. And so having this kind of decentralized system that has existed since our inception, you know, where you might have a residential facility, for example, and I'll use right here in Leon County, if you had a residential program setting right here as a facility, right now, Leon County Schools would have to provide the education. They would draw down the FTE funds, often referred to as the FEFP dollars, that fund education. They would provide teachers to place inside the facility and provide, you know, the required courses and access to education inside that facility itself. Well, not all counties have the same level of resources, because you can look at rural counties where we have a number of residential facilities that exist. And just again, there's broad variations in that quality when you have a decentralized system like we've had up to this point. And so what we've done through this legislation now is building up the capacity to have a statewide model where whether you're a youth that's being served in Pensacola or a youth that's being served in Miami, we can come to expect the same level of high-quality education and learning and make sure that they have access to great teachers and great content that help to accelerate that learning, close gaps, and have a youth either on track to being able to return to the, you know, the traditional schools when they transition out of our system at a point where they can reintegrate and have the degree of access to content in a way that supports them with their progression, or, and better yet, maybe even have that young person with the high school diploma in hand so that they're going back into a post-secondary educational setting to earn a degree or a credential, or even starting some of that while they're in our program. So that's where we're, again, we've created a funding model that's not based and bound under its current expectations, but again, creating this new unified system. You know, when you think about the nearly, you know, 2,300 to 2,400 youth that we're serving each year in our residential system, you know, these are programs that range anywhere from 6 months to 8 months on kind of the lower end of our residential continuum, up to some of our youth that may be there for up to 3 years and up to the age of 21. So we had to create this vision for how do we look at the funding, how do we look at the delivery of an educational model that is personally aligned to each individual youth that we serve, because you could be at a facility and you could have a classroom of 10, 12, 15 youth in one classroom. There might be a couple of youth that are in eighth grade, a couple that are in ninth, some that are in 10th, some that are working towards a GED. And so when you think about that broad variation in content, that definitely creates degrees of nuance that we had to really think about as we were designing this model through legislation, but also through the implementation with our contractor, which I'll talk more about here in just a minute. But now, as we go forward, we want to look at how do we provide that degree of variation and content exposure in ways that sometimes is a little bit challenging. And I'll just give you a real practical example. You know, if you're a young person who on your course schedule at one of our facilities is enrolled in an Algebra 1 class, well, we need to make sure that you're getting Algebra 1 content and not content that's maybe more aligned to general math or basic math, because at some point you've got to re-enter into a high school and you might be transitioning back in November or December. And if you're transitioning at that time and you're behind in all that content that all your peers in that class have had exposure to, think about the frustration and some of the challenges that may exist for that young person to catch up in the content. And then what does that potentially lead to down the road? Frustration leads to maybe potentially not going to school. Not going to school leads to violations of your post-commitment probation or your conditional release. All these things can spiral. So we're trying to make sure that we get way up front and really focus on that content and having our kids have access to that content and learning. So through this new system, we had to take that into consideration. As we're looking at where we're headed and we think about where we've gone, I think when I was in front of this body last time providing just updates on our legislative budget request, I briefly mentioned the Scholars Academy, and we are now at a point where we did contract October 20th with Florida Virtual Schools. We did a very significant due diligence, which I'll talk more about in a minute. And I think it's important to point out that when we talk about Florida Virtual Schools, I want to say it now, and I'm probably going to say it 10 more times in this presentation, we're not delivering a virtual school model. It's Florida Virtual Schools as the provider who is going to be hiring teachers to be in our classrooms and then leveraging their great content and resources to help supplement and really advance the learning of the youth in our system. So I always like to point that out because I think those are some of the questions that we got early on. Is this virtual school or is it truly a school setting with teachers in front of our students? And it really is a school setting with teachers in front of our students. The other thing that we're going to be doing here hand in hand with FLVS is looking at the career pathways that our youth will be on. So for that young person returning either to middle school or high school, how do we make sure that they're getting that early integration of exposure to career pathways and some of those credentials that they can earn that has them prepared when they reintegrate to the community? Or those young people that are getting a high school diploma while in our programs, or young people that can be enrolled in college or technical college programs while sitting in our facilities. That was, again, some of the modeling that we had to do in building out this new system, because under the FEFP, once that youth gets their high school diploma, there's no more education funding provided for that youth. And if that young person gets their high school diploma potentially in the first 2 or 3 weeks in their stay, what do we do to continue the education for that youth at that point in time? So these are the nuances that we've had to navigate, and that's where, again, for the first time ever, we're funding individual educational pathways for each youth in our system, regardless of whether it's K-12, post-secondary, technical education, or youth that are working towards a GED or a high school equivalency diploma. So again, first of its kind in the nation, and it's going to be a national model. We're excited about this. You know, we came with that commitment, and we're delivering on that commitment. And I really am excited about the resources and the assets that Florida Virtual School brings to the table, which is why ultimately we landed with them as the primary contractor. To kind of talk a little bit about the timeline, you know, last year in May when the legislation had officially passed, we were working through session, governor signed it into law. Of course, it didn't go into effect until July 1, but we hit the ground running. The first thing we did back in May is we put out a request for information. We wanted to see who out there had an interest in wanting to be, you know, involved in doing this work, because the way the legislation is written, it's not DJJ hiring teachers. We are allocated funds to then contract with a provider who can deliver the educational program across our system of you know, 40, almost 44 facilities across the state. So we put out a request for information through our procurement process to say, okay, again, who out there has an interest in being involved in this work? Who has the expertise, the capacity? And through that process, we had 4 individual organizations that submitted. And each had very great background. They had strong, you know, aspects of the program and model that we wanted to deliver. But we went from that information and we said, well, let's go into the next step of our due diligence, which was also talking to some of our public entities. So we talked to some state colleges. We talked to some of our school district partners, really engaging in, again, what are the things that we need to understand as we're building out this new continuum? And that's where Florida Virtual School really stood out when you think about already having statewide capacity. They've got a long history of being able to work with districts and schools. And they've got, you know, again, what I would say world-class content that is individually tailored, just like I mentioned earlier, with that young person who might be an Algebra 1, getting access to that content that helps them prepare when they go back to school. But from that timeline, you know, I think it's also important to point out that when it became law, July 1 of 2023, it also calls out a board. You know, as secretary, I'm proud to serve as the chair of the board, but we also had 4 additional members that were appointed to the board that are appointed by the governor. Those 4 board members have unbelievable expertise when it comes to education and workforce development here in our state. You know, our other 4 members include Bob Ward, who has been serving as the president and CEO with the Council of 100. When you think about that connection to business and industry, we have the vice president for CareerSource Florida, Dan McGrew, who is also on the board. Again, that connection to workforce beyond getting their high school diploma. We have Marva Johnson, who is the former chair for the State Board of Education. And then we also have Chris Moya, who has a great background in policy and understands both work in juvenile justice and education and school choice. So when you think about the expertise that's represented on that board to help ensure that we have a good, strong, accountable system for the youth that we're serving, again, I think we've really set the mark for what does it mean to have this world-class education, a national model, and doing it in a way that has high degree of public accountability. We had our first meeting on October 10th, and I can tell you it was a great meeting where we sat down, we went through, just like any other new board, we went through our ethics training, and we started to lay out the foundation for the department and the work that we're going to be doing under this model. And we'll have another board meeting here very soon where we'll be taking up the budget and the proposal for the staffing and the compensation model that the board has to approve that will be coming from FLVS. And at that point in time, we will also be approving the salary for the superintendent, who FLVS has identified a candidate that is submitted to me for review. And we hope to approve that superintendent candidate and announce that very soon, because that will be the real key leader to help make sure that we're implementing and delivering on these commitments, and also the individual that we'll hold accountable through the board and through the department to make sure we're hitting our marks on the commitments that we've made, not only through statute, but also through our expectations in delivering upon this vision for a high-quality education. When you think about the 3 entities that are involved, you know, again, anything that you're going to do of this magnitude, when you think about classrooms, again, from Pensacola to Miami, 2,400 youth may not sound like a large, you know, number of students, but when you think about the broad variation in, you know, academic challenges and some of the achievement gaps that we're trying to address, when you think about the broad geographical variabilities that we're working through, we had to make sure that, again, a provider like FLVS came to the table ready to hit the ground running. And so we had to look at what are the roles and responsibilities of the three entities. So I'll start with DJJ. Our role and responsibility, since we're named in statute as the one that receives the funds, we contract for these services. So we have to do our contract management duties, and we got to make sure we have the fiduciary responsibility of ensuring we stay on track with expenditures and the drawdowns of the dollars for delivering this program. The board is actually responsible for the governance and the overall accountability. So we'll be working with FLVS at the department to establish a school accountability model that would then go to our board, and then at the next stage, we'll go to the State Board of Education for approval so that we can hold our system accountable to the outcomes that we want to ensure are being achieved by our students and by the teachers and the programs in this model. And Florida Virtual School, of course, will have the education management. So they'll be hiring the teachers, they'll be hiring the administrators, the support staff, and everybody involved in delivering upon this program. Just to tell you a little bit about Florida Virtual Schools, for those of you that may not know their background, and these are all things that weighed heavily into our ultimate decision here. When you look at the fact they've got a 25-year history of delivering a product that is not just well-known and established here in the state of Florida, but really is seen as the national model and the gold standard when you talk about a virtual education system. You know, they have been around since 1996. It started out as an original partnership between Orange County Public Schools and Alachua County Public Schools. From there, it's grown not only to be a tool that's used across all 67 counties here in our state, but it's actually been expanded where many states around this country, 48 states in fact, in 65 countries and three U.S. territories, are using this content and tool to help continue to provide education for students, yes, through a virtual model, but again, they've been able to provide great expertise in this area and showing how do you leverage a broad geographic range with high-quality education to deliver outcomes. So for us, it's about how do you partner that kind of ability and capacity as a system, marry that with a great teacher in the classroom who can deliver and create the environment that's going to cultivate the learning, but also cultivate that school climate and community where kids are fostering that environment around learning. And so we're going to partner, again, what FLVS does well, hire those teachers, train those teachers, and where it's really exciting for us is now we've got the ability statewide to look at what are the evidence-based practices that drive teaching and learning in a consistent way, not in the decentralized model that we've had now where some might be doing it well and some are trying to, you know, meet the statutory requirements. Now we've got this unified model where we can take evidence-based practices, deliver upon that, but also look at what are those things that we know are going to work well for accelerating reading and math achievement. How do we do that in a way to where now we can train all of our teachers? And you think about this, and I'll go to that last bullet, like the school calendar and the daily schedule. You know, right now we have calendars that are different all across the state based on where the local district might adopt that calendar. And yes, they've got to do 250 days of school, but with that, those calendars all vary. When you think about bell schedules all vary from site to site. Now we can look at having that in a consistent way where now teachers all across the state as part of this new system can have common planning time. They can have common time to actually go to professional development to look at what are those skills and competencies we want them to develop as a unified system to drive that achievement that we're looking for in this model. How do we train teachers that are focused on career and technical education around those same skills and tools that are needed? So again, what this will do for us is unprecedented when you talk about, again, the decentralized model to now this more centralized approach, leveraging FLVS and the assets that they bring to the table. Things that we'll have to focus on, you know, going forward is, again, I mentioned the superintendent, recruit and evaluate instructional personnel. Just this week, we worked with FLVS to put out a survey to all of our district partners and to the teachers to look at the teachers that have an interest in applying to be a part of this model and to come on board. So we're working hand in hand with our districts on that piece. And we've had great outcomes already of people responding. And that's going to continue to be open for people to submit through this survey up until the 20th. The other thing that we'll be able to do is we talked about that professional development and kind of setting those high standards, but we also have to look at how are we setting up policies and procedures in this new model. So FLVS will be developing policies and procedures that will come into the department for review, and then we'll codify that with the board and bring that to the board for final approval. So again, just like a real school system, which again, it's a very unique process when you think about the individuals involved and the parties involved, but that public accountability to me is going to be the real standard that we have to meet. And working hand-in-hand with the Department of Education and the State Board of Education for what measures we're going to look at around things like academic growth. How many students are completing and actually earning their high school diploma that are eligible to do so while in our care? What kind of credentials are they achieving by the time they're transitioning out of our programs? How many kids that have post-secondary opportunities can actually enroll and participate in complete courses while in their facility? All these are things that, of course, we'll be taking into consideration as we build out that accountability model. you know, some additional developments. You know, when you've got 44 sites across the state, we're going to have to spend a lot of time on the ground where we're going into the facilities with FLVS, taking the lead, going in and looking at things like IT infrastructure, because we want to make sure that internet is in place at a level that is conducive to accessing content and resources. This is where you can also imagine where you've got that teacher in the classroom and you have that one student who needs to maybe take a foreign language course. You know, when you've got a small program of 30, 40 youth, you're not always going to have the ability to have that certified Spanish teacher there at the program. But now we can leverage that with the teacher in the classroom to help provide direct support. And now you can have students enroll in some of these online courses using that teacher through FLVS to take some of these other courses towards graduation, things that have not always been easily readily available within our facilities. But that's where we have to make sure that the internet, the IT infrastructure, all those pieces are in place. And so we're going to go site by site and work on those pieces and talk to the school districts that currently operate those facilities to see how we start to manage assets and resources, what things are going to be staying at the program, what things are the districts going to be potentially having to pull out because of inventory that's been funded through their district. Those are the nuances that we have to navigate over the next several months as we're getting ready for July 1st. And then develop a plan to promote parental involvement. Again, when you think about having a decentralized system, if you're someone whose child, let's say you live in Leon County, but your child is in a program, you know, down in Orange County, well, one of the things that sometimes is a little bit challenging is how much engagement do you have with that parent being involved in the education of their child? Now with one platform and one system, we can say, okay, just like me, you know, I've got kids that went to school. I got one that's a freshman in high school right now. I can get updates on an app every day and see how their grades are. I can do things that tell me, okay, how do I engage with the teacher to see how my child's doing? We're going to be able to bridge really communication between education and our parents in ways that we haven't been able to do before. Because in the end, we want our parents to be engaged in that learning process. We want them to be a partner in that process in ways that we haven't necessarily contemplated in the past. And so that plan is currently under development by FLVS, and we'll be working with them to make sure that it's a plan that can be implemented and supported to, again, have parents involved in that education of their child in ways that, like I said, we haven't been able to do in the past. Additional things that we'll be doing is looking at the different CTE pathways. We want to hone in on those reading skills. We want to look at what kind of literacy-based plan FLBS is going to come to the table with so that we can you know, make sure that it's evidence-based, it's rooted in the research, what are the instructional practices that teachers will be delivering. And then also, you know, looking at those specialized services for ESC and English language learners. All things are required in a traditional school, but now we can make sure that we can leverage because they have an entire ESE department. They have an entire department that's dedicated to doing this work already. So how do we leverage that and overlay that with the teachers that we have at the facility doing the work that we're doing? And also, when you think about career counseling, some of our programs right now don't always have access because if it's a smaller district or rural district, now we can access their career counselors and other individuals that can, you know, join the teacher in the classroom, maybe do a virtual session with the parent and the child, and talk about what are the different career pathways that we can leverage now. Again, all these are things that, as we're moving forward, we're excited about, but that is what makes this model so much different than what we've been doing currently, historically, and what will be, again, a game changer for the country and people looking to Florida and how we've delivered on this model and this commitment for our kids. So with that, Mr. Chair, I want to pause for any questions and appreciate the opportunity to be here, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Members, are there any questions? Rep. Snyder, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I can, Chair, not so much of a question as much of it is just a comment and some loud rah-rahs from this corner of the cheering section on what you guys are doing. I would put the challenge out to the members on this committee, if you have not had a chance yet, to go see some of the great work that's happening at DJJ right now. It's impressive. Thank you, Deputy Secretary Campbell. And your team for the tour down in South Florida. It is amazing to see, and again, just kind of keep the kudos going, Rep. Jacques, for what you've done. And I remember hearing the concept of this coming out last year, but to actually see it, and when you realize if there is an opportunity to break the cycle and to give these kids, and that's what it is. I mean, it's also there are children in there that need that opportunity, and so to bring in just the resources and take it from kind of that helter-skelter district approach, where we know we're in a teacher shortage. I think this is some of the most important work that we're doing up here, and so just want to say thank you again, Mr. Secretary, and keep up the great work.
Ranking Member Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Secretary Hall. Thank you so much for your presentation. I am just so excited about this program because I see that there's hope. And thank you, Representative Jacques, for allowing me to be your prime co-sponsor on this bill. As you know, my tenure on the Hillsborough County Public School Board, this was a calling for me to be able to help these children. So I have a couple of questions based on your presentation. So students that are in your program, will be in this program, cannot drop out.
You're recognized. Sure.
Thank you. That is a great point, that they would not be dropping out because we would have an expectation for education.
Follow up.
Thank you. So considering the, and you may not have the answer to this question, but how will we motivate, excite the students to want to be there and to excel? What are kind of the strategies?
You're right.
If you have them.
Two parts to that. I think first and foremost is creating a culture that prioritizes education. You know, I think when students get access to content and information that is relevant to what they're enrolled in and what things they should be doing, now it becomes something that they understand is really a process for them getting back into school, doing the things that they need to. So I think at the highest level, without drilling down into the classroom-based competencies or strategies that teachers will deploy, the biggest part is how do we make sure that education across our system is a top priority? And that goes through our treatment team process. It goes into how do the facility administrators, who we've been working with, all of our residential providers, as we're bringing this forward. But it starts at the top. It starts by saying, okay, do we as a system prioritize education as a part of our process for rehabilitation and reintegration back into the community? As we prioritize that and we look at how we train our teachers, again, now in a way that we've never been able to do across an entire continuum, I think those are strategies that we'll be working with FLBS to say, okay, what are the things that we need to consider? They have multiple plans within their contract that they got to bring forward for approval that we'll be diving into and working with them. They've been a great partner. We have weekly meetings as we're going through progress, you know, for implementation. But I think getting into those details, we'd be happy to come back or at least share with you what those strategies look like. But I think at the highest point, it's about how do you prioritize it, make sure it's at the classroom level and that there's an excitement for learning and that it's relevant to the students in the classroom. Because if they don't see that it's relevant and aligned to their progress, then they're going to perceive it as something that, you know, potentially is not necessarily worth their time. And we got to change that narrative in some cases.
Follow-ups? This is exciting stuff.
Follow-up, please.
This is just so exciting.
The teacher in you coming out.
Absolutely. Well, so let's talk about the contract. When we contracted with FLVS, I see that they're going to be, you mentioned that they were going to be providing policies and procedures for the board to adopt. That's kind of sort of different. Usually boards are the ones that promulgate the policies to the superintendent, and then the superintendent, along with its team, promulgate the procedures to carry through. Why the difference?
Recognized.
So a lot of this is we'll be co-creating that as the department through contract management, and that's where this ends up being a little bit different. When you think about the superintendent, for example, the superintendent is technically an employee of FLBS. So as they're employed by FLBS in this case, they will create and bring that forward like a superintendent would to the board. We'll monitor that and check that as a department to make sure it complies with our policies, procedures, and things that we know are important to the department as a whole and to the state. But as we check those things together, then we'll bring that to the board for approval. I think in this case, because it's not a typical superintendent employed directly by the board, it's a contract between the department and the private entity. And with their superintendent, they'll bring that forward for us to review and make sure that it's aligned.
One more, please.
One more.
Thank you. So in reference to the recruitment and retainment of teachers, you mentioned that you're going to be coming back with FLBS to discuss salary schedules and things of that nature. How will that be a separate contract from the original contract that was set by that you procured with Florida Virtual?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it wouldn't be a separate contract. Right now, the way the contract reads is that during the first 30 days of the contract, they've got to develop their compensation schedule and everything else that would then be presented for us to take to the board along with the full budget. So there's the total dollar amount, and then they've got to take that dollar amount and deconstruct that into the budget priorities that we'll review and approve. That would include the compensation guide.
My very last one, Mr. Chair, I promise. My very last one.
Last one.
Thank you. So talk to me about the dynamic of the virtual side versus an in-person teacher and the wraparound services, because that's a lot. So how's that going to be managed? Thank you. I'm done.
Not sure that was a question, but.
Yep.
It was. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think, you know, part of it's going to be making sure that we have a teacher in the classroom who understands what it means to accelerate learning, especially in those areas of reading and math, because we got to make sure they understand the science of reading, what are the things that we need to do to, again, accelerate learning, since so many of the kids are about 3 to 4 grade levels behind many times in their abilities for reading and math achievement. So we want to make sure we ground those aspects of the teaching and learning experience, but then leverage that with the content, because, again, when you've got 10 or 15 kids in a classroom all with different courses on their schedule, we want to look at how do we design that to where we can leverage the online content, but with the teacher who can create common threads that can lead to direct instruction. So there might be some principles, and I'm going to make this as an example, say in English language arts. So whether you're in, you know, middle school ELA, whether you're doing ELA at the high school level, there probably are some common content areas that could be taught across the board and then differentiated based on ability and achievement levels. But some of that explicit content could be reinforced and supported through the virtual school content, or like an ELA 1, ELA 2, you know, those types of things, if that makes sense. And then I think with the support services, they do have a whole team with, you know, academic advising, counseling, and things that we'll be able to leverage through their system. So.
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Secretary, I appreciate everything you're doing, and I share the cheering section with Rep. Snyder. Just want to ask, it seems to be a significant focus on education, which I sincerely appreciate, but I know that two other components of that are drug addiction and mental health counseling. Can you just speak very generally, like, what else are you doing in those two areas to ensure success for these children once they leave your facilities?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So obviously this is the educational piece while they're inside our programs, and each one of our contracted providers, for those that don't know, when we have a youth that comes into our system and the court commits them to DJJ, they're typically going to commit the youth either into a non-secure, high-risk, or max-risk facility based on, you know, their background and history. From that, we do a comprehensive evaluation that helps us to determine whether it's, you know, there's a need for substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, and other things that may align more to that mental health arena. From there, we start to look at which of our facilities, based on our contracts, have the expertise and the contractual requirements for substance abuse counseling and mental health. Sometimes it's intensive, sometimes it's an overlay, but in the end, those services are started while they're in the facility with the clinicians and others while they're in residential care. And then as they're transitioning out, it's up to that treatment team to determine, is there going to be follow-up needed in the community? In other words, did they complete their treatment and counseling while in the program, or is there going to be a need for follow-up? So all that would be part of their transition planning, and we definitely want to prioritize that, you know, right in line with education. So we will continue our commitment there, but I would tell you, we, thanks to the legislature and to the governor's budget, you know, we've been able to continue to make sure that we can recruit and retain the talent that we need in those areas as well, getting the clinicians and others in place. So we will continue to see how I think those outcomes will improve by getting those professionals in front of our youth the way we need.
Representative Jocks, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Hall, I just want to commend you. Major kudos for truly implementing this. It used to be just a dream when you and I were talking about this early on, and to see this being rolled out with a provider and everything going as planned is truly a testament to your leadership. And I want to echo Rep. Snyder and encourage members of the committee to also visit a residential facility in your area or anywhere in the state. It truly is enlightening. And thank you, Representative Valdez, ranking member, for joining me in this mission. Your expertise in education truly mattered. I did have one question, Mr. Secretary. You mentioned that a plan will be developed to promote parental involvement within the Florida Scholars Academy, and I truly appreciate you having that focus on parental involvement. For the youth who may not have a involved parent, right, and say they're in the system, DCF or guardian, would there still be a system available to engage whoever that adult is in their life?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. One of the things we would expect to see in that plan is for, you know, our youth that may be system involved, not with just DJJ, but with DCF. Who is the adult that's going to be that caring individual to help continue that youth support when they come out of our residential care? So I think in the end, parent is kind of as a broad term. The parent is used for those that are the parent and guardian, or the guardian, or an extended family member. And in some cases, for some of our you know, young adults that may be coming out that are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, who is going to be that caring person that we can connect them with to make sure that there's still somebody out there to be that coach and cheerleader for them when they transition out?
Thank you.
Representative Stark, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit of after the path versus the program itself. I had the privilege of touring the detention center in Orange, Osceola. Was very impressed. Your commander there is very knowledgeable and very friendly. My question is, in that conversation, he indicated that a lot of the children that were in that particular facility, they have the stigma, so to speak, after they get out of having that record, and sometimes they have difficulties getting job placements and that kind of thing. And a lot of them have entrepreneurial spirits. And so is there any consideration to trying to put a program together that assists these people to set up their own business as they're coming out of the system to be able to be successful on their own versus feeling like they're answering to someone else and the other challenges come forward?
You're recognized.
I would say absolutely. And I think if I could, you know, maybe speak to that in a little bit more detail, I think we have to look at what is that core competency that we need to make sure that young person can develop. Let's say it's something in welding or something in the line. I've got a young man right now who was one of our youth ambassadors this past year named Giovanni. You know, he has an interest in car detailing, so he has set up his own business, and he's out there running a car detailing business. And he's doing great. I mean, he's been to a couple of events and spoken about that kind of entrepreneurial spirit that he has and how he's building out that business in his local community. So I think there's great opportunities to look at how do we support entrepreneurship, but what is that skill and that passion that the individual youth has? How do we hone those skills so that they first get those competencies they need for a credential and trade that then can lead them either to being a direct employee and build that entrepreneurial spirit to be able to become their own, you know, business and industry at some point if that's what they choose? But I think those options are things that, you know, we've got to start. Have we arrived yet? But it's definitely something we need to keep on the forefront.
Well, I would really look forward to that being a discussion as we move forward because I think it's a need. And I have one other chair, if you don't mind.
You're recognized for a final question.
And this may not be so much as of a question, and it's not necessarily related to the educational piece of it. But in the conversation, I was unaware that these students that are in the detention centers, when they're there and they're placed because we don't have another facility to move them to and that sort of thing, that time that they spend in the detention center is not counted towards their overall sentence. Is that correct?
Recognized.
Yes, ma'am. So a youth who's placed in detention, and let's say they go to court and the court commits them to one of those three levels, a non-secure, high-risk, or max-risk facility, there could be a period of time where initially there's almost like 30 days oftentimes where you have to get the full commitment packet together. That's when you're doing the assessments, the comprehensive eval, to understand what are the specific needs. Because once the court makes that decision to one of those three levels, we have to decide, is there intensive substance abuse, mental health, and all those other needs that we put into that assessment that determines the placement into which program. But we're not a time-based system. So because it's not a time-based system, your performance starts to really work towards your treatment plan. So the assessment drives the treatment plan when they get to their program. Once they get to the program, that treatment plan lays out education goals, treatment goals, behavioral goals, other things for reentry. That first day at the program is what starts their progression, because even though it may be 6 to 8 months in a like a non-secure, it could be longer if a youth is not necessarily, you know, meeting those goals to support them on their transition. You have some kids that hit the ground running and can do it, you know, sometimes in 6 months. But to your point, because it's not time-based, their progression towards their plan doesn't start till that first day at the program.
Thank you very much. Seeing no other questions, Secretary Hall, thank you very much for your presentation today.
Thank you.
All right, through the last General Appropriation Acts, the Florida Department of Corrections has been appropriated historic increases in funding to raise the starting base salary of corrections officers and series of employees with additional resources to assist in recruitment and training for new hires. Furthermore, through the Inmate Welfare Trust Fund, the department has been provided additional resources to support education opportunities of inmates under the department's supervision. Here today to provide us with an update on the department's staffing and training initiatives, as well as a brief overall of the Inmate Welfare Trust Fund, is Secretary Ricky Dixon.
Hey,
you are recognized, sir.
Chair Smith, Ranking Member Valdez, and members, thank you for having me here today. Thank you especially on behalf of our 24,000 staff. And I'll say this, many of them are watching today across Florida. Many of them are tuned into this presentation. So on behalf of them, thank you for your interest in our agency, your personal visits, and just all you've been doing to continue to drive us forward. As you mentioned, we've had historic pay increases and resources, and we're seeing the fruits of that. And I'll share some of that today. So thank you. And I'll talk today specifically, as you've requested, on staffing, training, and education. First of all, just some quick statistics, if I may. Most of you are aware of these by now. We have almost 24,000 staff in our system, around 18,000 authorized security positions, inmate populations are a little over 85,000, and about 140,000 on some type of community supervision. I will note about 79% are either certified correctional officers or correctional probation officers in our system. I can go to the next slide here. I've said this over and over that we often overcomplicate this thing. It just comes down to three basic areas we have to address to restore our system, and that's staffing challenges, inmate idleness, and infrastructure. And I'll speak to each one of those briefly. With what you've done with the retention or with the pay raises, that's gone a long way to impact our staffing challenges statewide. We've got some geographic issues I'll speak to, but we're doing well there. I can pretty much take inmate idleness off this list. With what you all did last year, the 215 educators, injecting those in our system is going to make a tremendous difference, not only in driving down the violence, because we'll reduce inmate idleness, but also in public safety in general. You know, our public safety roles goes far beyond just keeping people behind our fences. You know, 90,000, almost 90% of those in our custody is going to get out one day. We release over 20,000 a year, and we take in over 20,000 a year. So not to prepare them to get a job where they can get housing is not a recipe for success. So this is going to be a game changer in terms of our ability to educate the population and prepare them for work, the workforce. I will say, back to staffing challenges, though, to do that successfully, you have to have the security staff there to run the system. Finally, infrastructure. When I speak of infrastructure, I'm talking fleet, IT, our information technology systems, and certainly our physical plant issues that are pretty significant. I just left a presentation over in the Senate with KPMG. That study's coming to close, and they referenced a lot of the challenges there. I do want to slow down for just a minute. I almost feel guilty coming over and asking for additional resources each year, as good as the past years have been. But I think it's important to stop and slow down and just go over what you have provided already. Historic pay raises, $22 an hour, $5,000 hiring bonuses at hard-to-fill locations, education and program expansion I just mentioned, teacher pay increases, and I won't read them all to you, but on and on and on. Resources like we've not experienced in the last decade have all occurred in the last year or two, thanks to your leadership and your support. Moving on to the next slide, I'll just share a little bit about the trend line statewide. You know, today I'm speaking mainly about security staff, but I don't want to fail to mention that all areas of our system has been struggling in terms of staffing, to include classification, maintenance, medical, educators. Now, not only did you provide 215 teachers, but the pay increased to about $50,000 a year, so it's made us competitive, so we're rapidly hiring teachers. You'll notice that we were spiraling downward before the pay increased in December, as that graph indicates. I do want to note that the significant vacancy rate reduction in March of 2022 was related to us forfeiting security positions to assist with self-funding a portion of our pay raise. So that's that dip you see there. And then also, as you'll notice, the pay increase in July of 2023, both had the desired effect. We're moving in the right direction statewide at those two moments in time. This next slide is just it's just net gains and net losses. It's a different way of looking at our staffing turnaround. As you see, prior to March of 2022, a lot of 20s there, we were losing more staff each month than we were gaining. We turned the corner shortly after the LBC action in December of 2021, and simply as talks began of the significant pay increase that would follow. Now, the anomaly you see there in December, that's just December's historically not a good month for hiring with the holidays and all. But here's the real story, and here's why you still hear of challenges with staffing. Although the statewide numbers are improving, the problem is it's a geographic problem. Those prisons in the north, in the panhandle you see there, and in the north section of Florida under Region 2, are still struggling. If I go to the text boxes, you'll see that we're doing pretty good in Regions 3 and 4, around 3.47 in Region 3 vacancy rate, and about 10.4 in Region 4. I'll point out that in Region 4, it's a lot better than that. We have two exceptions, Hardee and Okeechobee there are struggling. They're much like the prisons in the Panhandle there in rural areas, so we're struggling with that, with the staffing there. Again, back to the Panhandle in the north, we've got a number of prisons that aren't functioning at 100%. We've closed a number of dorms and a lot of facilities there simply because we don't have the manpower to staff it. What that's resulted in is we have to push the population south and over-compress the prisons in the south, making them more dangerous and volatile, just because we've got dorms sitting empty in the north. Now, you've been responsive. We have got a $5,000 pay additive to those, to 15 of those prisons. There's about 18 we're struggling, but 15 of them, there is a $5,000 pay additive. We've chose to divide that pay additive up into four payments of four sections or four groups. We're waiting on the second payment to go out. So we haven't had a long time to see the responsiveness we'll get from that action. But I will say, even with the first payment, we had record hires and record retention. So it's a good indicator that we're on the right track as it relates to that. You'll see here, I'll just kind of drill down. I just mentioned broadly 15 prisons, 18 we're struggling with, 15 has the additional pay additive. Here's a granular example, though, of what it means. You see there on the left, Suwannee CI, got seven dorms closed there. So that represents about, looking for the capacity, about 1,000 beds that we can't use there based on those seven dorms closed. So we've got 1,000 beds there that we just aren't able to operate. Same thing if you look over to Franklin, 740 beds there we can't utilize because we've got five dorms closed. So, again, that's the reason we're having to push that population south. Our desire and our hope is that this additional pay, causes us to restore staffing in those locations, that we can open those dorms back up and move the population back north. Unfortunately, a lot of those dorms are very well from a physical plant standpoint. Some are even air-conditioned. So it's sad to have those good physical structures, especially at Franklin, sitting empty because of staffing. Here's just a list of where the $5,000 additive has been applied. I will say that, we talk about turnover rate and all that, and it's pretty high statewide. But if you look at those that come to our system with 6 years or less of service, their turnover rate's around 60% or higher. So we experience a lot of turnover. Usually if you stay with us 7, 8, 9 years, we've got you because they are kind of bought into the retirement system and they stay with us. So it's kind of why we recommended in our LBR this year retention pay at the 6-year mark and under, some steps, some carrots, so to speak, to entice these people to stay and not leave at 18 months or 2 years. It's a tremendous expense to the state when we hire somebody and keep them a year or two because we invest quite a bit in their training and their time. Now, I will say, I'll give you just an example. We have about 2,800 vacancies in the system right now. Well, in addition to that, we've got another 2,000 in the academies and in a training status. So that's 4,800 people we don't have in place. So not only do we have to deal with the 2,800 vacancies, but we have to compensate for the 2,000 that are sitting in class through overtime. So I've got the value of $4,800 worth, 4,800 people in terms of hours in a given week that we have to compensate for with overtime. It's about 80,000 hours, man hours, a week that we've got to cover in overtime. So, some could say, well, overtime is not going down when you're hiring. Well, we're hiring, but we're putting that individual in a class for a period of time. So that's something we're experiencing, and it's why we've requested that retention pay in some format for those people with less tenure with us. I do want to say this. I think it's important to recognize that we can't look to state government for all of our answers. We've got to do a lot internally, and we have been. And I want to share that with you. We've been, it's not just how much you make. That's a very important factor, and we advocate for that all the time. But you've got to enjoy where you work. And so we've worked extremely hard to bring back morale and that family atmosphere throughout our system. We've never seen morale this high. We've got something special going on right now in our agency. And I won't credit the things I'm going to share with you entirely. It's largely based on the pay increases that you've all provided. But I don't underestimate what our internal efforts is doing. We're doing employee appreciation events all over the state. A lot of you have joined us in those events where we gather a lot of folks up and have a meal and bring different legislators in to speak with them. That's having huge impacts. We're doing what we call executive leadership team on the road. Once a quarter, we take the entire executive leadership team out, and we spend a week in the prisons, not just in the admin building, not on day shift, but nights, weekends, evenings, in the towers, in the dorms, in the classification offices, listening to those staff and learning, getting firsthand knowledge of some of the challenges they're dealing with. So that's gone a long way to improve morale. We've improved communications through use of video, cutting out the middlemen, talking directly to 24,000 staff, keeping them informed of the things we're doing and the efforts we're taking on their behalf. So, again, that just to share that we're doing a lot of internal efforts to make sure. I always said you can't run a prison from the warden's office, and you can't run this agency from Tallahassee. You've got to be out there with them, and that's going a long way. Recruitment campaigns, you funded us significantly to focus on recruitment. You may have seen some of these billboards up and down the interstate. We're proud of those. They're paying huge dividends. So we've got billboards up all over the panhandle. We also have radio ads, TV ads, extensive online and social media campaigns throughout the state. The National Guard, we have 300 guardsmen that we're maintaining in our system. That's working phenomenally. It's not a long-term sustainable solution. We know that, so we want to make ourselves whole where we can release them. I do want to take a minute to thank Major General John Haas for his willingness to help us out, the General of the National Guard, and his service members for what they meant to our agency. Just some internal strategies that we've been kind of positioned to have to deploy. And it's working pretty well, but some things we're doing is we're staffing the middle part of the state and the southern part of the state pretty well. So what we've started doing is hiring to 100%, even beyond that in some cases, in the middle part of the state. And then for those that volunteer to do it, we take staff and we ship them up to the north part of the state to man some of these dorms. And the way we do that is we'll work them like 7 days straight, extended hours, and then give them a choice of either a long time, you know, 5 or 6 days off when they go back, or maybe a week off, or go back and help the surrounding facilities to compensate for their deficiencies in staffing. And it's working pretty well. We've also in some locations said, hey, you know, you've got a neighboring prison an hour away that's struggling. We need you to go to that prison. Now, they're doing that at their own expense. Many times they're having to pay to drive further, and they're going to a more challenging population setting sometimes. So that's a delicate balance. We don't want to push that so hard they leave. But we're certainly appreciative of the ones willing to step up and volunteer to do that. And I'll move on now to the second part, training. You asked for an overview on training. I'll just tell you that, understanding the training and certification process will provide insight into why you've not seen a large increase in our system's capacity. I just explained that, so I won't go into that again with them in the class. But, the bottom line, when we hire an individual, they don't go right to work. They've got to be trained. It takes roughly about 6 months to get them in the door, to get them processed, to get them through the training. The training academy itself is about a 13-week program, but with the churn and the turnover and all that, we're not in a position to put them to work immediately. Again, you funded us $2.3 million to modernize our correctional officer academies. As you can see on the screen there, we've updated laptops, tablets for academy coordinators. I mean, we were literally pencil and paper prior to the funding that you provided last year. So digital training solutions, hardware and software, so we're going to get more nimble. We're going to get, this training process will be smoother and definitely turn out a better product in a more efficient manner. So thank you for all of the support in that area. So education expansion. As indicated earlier, we're extremely appreciative of the resources there. Game-changing, as I mentioned, in terms of what it'll mean for our system immediately and long-term impacts in Florida. We have over, I think you know this stat probably, I've said it several times, but over half of our population has about a sixth grade level, which is pretty shocking. 4.8 TABE scores, literacy scores based on TABE. So we've got a lot of work there to do just to teach them to read and get them a GED or high school equivalency. As you can see above, just to put this in perspective, we've gone from 11.6% or about 8,583 to now over 20.9% or 15,000 that will now have access to academic and career technical programs within our system. So that is a huge leap forward. And it's really better than that sounds. You know, to say that there's 15,000 seats doesn't mean that only 15,000 inmates has access in a given year, because there's turnover for those seats. So we're in a very good place as it relates to that. You see on the screen there, we're rapidly filling those education vacancies. Here you see that the stats as it relates to each discipline, but bottom line, you know, we've hired over 125 educators in just the last several months, so we're doing well there. That would not have been possible without that pay increase to 50,000. Before that, we had teacher vacancies all across Florida, so we appreciate that. I do want to plug here something we're going to ask for this year is special risk retirement for a lot of the people behind our fence that don't get it. You know, it's not just people who wear a uniform that work in a volatile, dangerous environment. From our chaplains to our teachers to our maintenance guys to our classification staff, they're often in settings alone with volatile individuals. And I could give example after example of some of the outcomes and some of the assaults that they've experienced. So we're going to ask to include that group in our special risk category for retirement, and that will go a long way, too, with recruitment and retention. So as you see here, we've installed 55 learning labs across Florida, 12 new portable classrooms, adding 800 substance use treatment and counseling seats. I just mentioned the special risk. We're partnering with outside employers for increased workforce opportunities. Again, every opportunity we have to not depend on government for some of these training opportunities, I think, is important. So timing's right in terms of the workforce needs across Florida to partner with employers to not only take our individuals and give them a job when they get out, but we're telling them we'll open our doors and give you training space where you can come in and provide the training where these individuals are ready to go to work day one. No cost to the state to do that. So it's been a success. And then finally, we're working with our partners like Pride, our prison industries program. And they do great work, but they need to scale up. And we've communicated that with them very clearly that we want to expand on those jobs within the prisons that they provide and the opportunities to touch more of the population. So with that said, I'll stop there and just take any questions. Thank you again.
And thank you, Secretary Dixon. And members, questions? I know Rep. Fabrizio, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Secretary. Excellent presentation, and I want to commend you and your staff. I had the opportunity to visit one of the prisons before the committee week started, and prior to that, one of the other prisons down in South Florida. And I find there to be a huge value to visiting the prisons and seeing what's going on. So I want to thank you and your staff for all the help you provided with that. And I think you're doing a heck of a job. Just a couple of quick questions, if I can be recognized for a series. The first question, early on you mentioned in your presentation that Region 4 is generally doing pretty well with regard to employment numbers. But you mentioned that there were, except for two prisons in Region 4. I think you mentioned Okeechobee, and I forgot this.
Hardy.
What's going on with those prisons in particular that they're having trouble with the employee numbers?
You're recognized.
It's a very similar situation to what we're facing in the north. Those two prisons are in rural areas, and just because of their proximity to the towns around them, they don't where they're positioned, they don't have the work, the applicant flow that some others do.
Okay.
And I will add, if I could too, those are both pretty tough prisons. We do find disparity or difference in staffing our lower custody prisons versus our higher custody prisons. Those two mentioned are pretty tough population types, so our turnover rate there is pretty significant.
Okay. Second question, and thank you for that. You mentioned also that you had approximately 300 members of the National Guard providing, I guess they're standing posts and providing some sort of security functions in prisons throughout the state. What I'm interested in knowing is, I probably should have asked through your staff otherwise, but what is the cost that the state of Florida is incurring for using those 300 members of the Florida National Guard? That's number one. And then number two, how is that number compared to what you would pay for a regular employee to perform that same job function?
I hesitate to give you an exact number because I don't want to guess. I need to follow up with you on the number. I'll tell you this, though. In terms of the cost, it's somewhat comparable, I would say. It's as I mentioned earlier, it's not a sustainable way to go forward. Now, it is offset. The cost, I would say, is offset because these vacancies do generate a certain number of amount of funds. So it's not like in every case that we have to have extra funds to pay for that. There is dollars generated through the vacancies.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Last question, I promise, for today. I understand that there may be some vendors that would be interested in providing some sort of security function. So a third-party private contractor would be interested in providing some security functions at the outside gates, at the doors, and things of that nature. Is that something that you've explored? Is that a viable option, or is that something that gives you pause and concern?
No pause at all. I'm staying in contact with my counterparts in other states. That's a model being used. The front gate is an excellent place to do it because it's an outside group coming in doing the searches, not people that work with each other every day searching. So we've contemplated it, and we may be asking for that at some point. We're looking, taking a hard look at that.
Is there a cost savings?
Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
There's a minimal cost savings. There is.
Thank you so much.
Ranking Member Valdez, you're recognized. Noting we have multiple public testimony comments, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Dixon, thank you so much for your presentation today. And I know how hard you and your staff are working. That does not go unnoticed, so I want you to know that. I noticed that you spoke about, when you spoke about staff appreciation, that brings me joy. I think that even, you know, the most little accolade that you can give goes a long way, such as a smile as well. My question to you is, since you had these chats with the staff at the different prisons that you've been visiting, have you had an opportunity to talk to some of the incarcerated constituents and find out what their experiences are, or
That's a great question, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Yeah, we're going further than just listening. We're actually acting upon what we're hearing from them, and I can give you a great example of that, and I've shared it before. We're actually up to about 11 incentivized prisons now, where we take those that are cooperating and doing well and put them in those kind of environments. It's amazingly successful. The violence rates in those prisons are very low. Now, it's a tough bar there to stay in tune with if they don't cooperate and focus on their education and they don't stay there. Or if they're violent or have disciplinary issues, they don't stay there. So that if you talk to the population, and I do all the time, that's the violence levels impact them and concern them as bad as they do us. They absolutely don't want to live in those environments. So they're grateful for some of the population management strategies that we're developing to keep them safer. And we're mitigating violence, very, very proud of the extent to which we've mitigated violence, even in these times with low staffing. So great, great question.
Representative Snyder, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Secretary. Again, thank you for everything that you do and for all the men and women keeping us safe within DOC. Going back to the effort on hiring the teachers, I know some of the other conversations we're having in other committees is centered around the teacher shortage and the struggle that, you know, just the traditional school districts, charter schools, private schools are having to find qualified, certified teachers. Just curious how you guys are tackling that problem, if that's been an issue, and if there's anything we can do to help continue to support that effort.
You're recognized.
I think you already did. When our pay was in the 30s, we could not fill positions in prisons. We could not. Now that the pay has gone to around $50,000, we have hundreds of applications in the hopper. What I expect, though, is at some point we will learn that we're doing well in certain geographic areas of the state and not others. So we may get to a point we have to move those positions to areas of the state where we can fill them and let those prisons concentrate a little more on education than some others do. Hope that's not the case. I hope it's distributed somewhat equally across the state and all of the facilities because it's impactful. But if not, we will try to be wise about how we try to distribute those positions.
Representative Jock, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Dixon, thank you for your leadership at the Department of Corrections. And as a former prosecutor, I know how vital your role is and your department's role. I've had the opportunity to tour a number of your correctional facilities and interacted not only with leadership, but rank and file staff. And what I can say to the members of this committee that they truly are appreciative, and I can feel the morale is very strong based on the work that we've been doing. And so I'm committed to build upon that so we can continue to see morale sky high. And so that can help with recruitment and retention as well. I earlier today, I met with two of your great wardens, Warden Woodard and Warden Pointer, from Polk and Hernando, respectively, and they do amazing work. I got to interact with them out in the field, and to get the updates in my office today was just so wonderful to see all the great things that they're doing and some of the things that you discussed here in your presentation. And on Friday, I'll be at Florida State Prison and Union Correctional to interact some more. I had a question regarding filling some of those job numbers, specifically Region 2, not too far from here in Perry, Florida. We heard the devastating news when that paper mill decided to go out of business right on the heels of Hurricane Idalia. We're talking about 2,000 displaced workers now. What has your department been doing in engaging some of these now unemployed individuals to maybe bring them into the department?
You're recognized.
Sure, great question. Very unfortunate for that area of the state, but we hope to benefit from that and benefit them and let them sustain some type of employment there. So we've reached out not only to the company but those individuals as well. There's a little bit of lag with the transition of the mill actually closing. So, but we have a lot of applications in process, people that want to come work with us. So we think we're just weeks away from gaining. I think the last number I heard was around 50 or 60, which is huge for Taylor Correctional Institution. I will tell you, in regards to Taylor, we have an entire unit closed there. So we would love to gain several hundred and be able to open that entire facility back up. And that would take some of the pressure off of the South if we could do that.
And thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate your comments and we share in your success. Keep up the good work.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
All right. We will now move into public testimony. We'll start with Ms. Jackie Dunn, Data for Change. As you move up to the microphone, please ensure it's on and you are recognized.
You know I'm not going to get out of here without saying something. Thank you for your time, and thanks to Secretary Dixon for what he's doing. Obviously, it goes without saying that, you know, if we could get the population down and quit increasing our incarcerated population so astronomically, the money that we would save could be used to focus on the people that really need this training. The 44% that leave prison without their GED. I'm very hopeful that the trust fund money will start to show this idleness, like he said, going away and programming going up. The problem is if they're not incentivized to do it, I don't know what we're going to force them to do it, you know, like, and they're going to be better for it. The more trained, the more educated, the more faith-based they are, the more engaged, the better they're going to be when they come out. It's just a proven fact. So let's incentivize them. Why is that such a big deal to incentivize? We're spending astronomical amounts of money. When you see the KPMG report, it's astronomical. So we've got the numbers. We've got the numbers to show this just really low recidivism rate of people that are released after the age of 50. People like my son that are in for DUI manslaughter. You know, why are we using the most expensive way possible to take up space and resources in a prison when they could be on house arrest or they could be in a non-traditional, you know, punishment environment that is better for everybody. So, I mean, I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but at the end of the day, we're at a breaking point, and we're either going to spend, you know, millions and billions and billions of dollars on this KPMG stuff, or we're going to have to start making some hard choices, and we have the data to do it. So let's start making the choices that we need to make that makes all the families in Florida in a better place and the taxpayers.
Thank you very much. And we have one from Kim White, who's waving in support of the DOC's presentation. Let's go with Nathan Shade. He's working up, and we'll have Lorette, you're on deck. Nathan, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. I've never spoken in one of these before. Promised myself I never would. But we're at Okeechobee. We are actually in four of the top 20 institutions that are difficult as far as staffing. We run a faith and character program, Horizon Communities Corporation. We have a 5% recidivism rate after 24 years of doing this. It is outstanding to watch the men that work at places like Okeechobee, Franklin, Calhoun, who are so short-staffed, working alongside National Guard at some of those places. But seeing them sweating in the heat outside with no shade, seeing them uncharacteristically behaving and sometimes apologizing to me, like, I don't never normally act this way. If we could find ways to help some of these officers with the heat, with the situations that they're in. Also with our program, we don't take up space. We do all of our work inside the dorms where the men and women sleep. And so it's really it's helpful for us to watch people's behavior change, to watch staff assaults go down, to watch inmate assaults go down, all those types of things that happen, and it costs us very little. I was in the Marines. We do little. We do a lot with little. And so it was always fun to kind of watch that happen. I kind of taken that to heart and take that into my work. That's why we show up at the hard places. The Secretary has done amazing things with incentivized programs. We try to go to the places where they're not incentivized, find the people that are causing problems, and reduce those problems. So for me, just to kind of speak quickly on this part, everything that the Secretary is trying to do needs to be done. If anything that you can do to support that, I call out to the faith communities. We need to fill these roles, these vacancies, with men and women of faith that want to help see people's lives change. Thank you.
Thank you. Lorette Phillipson. And you are recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I do recognize the changes that Secretary Dixon is making within the Department of Corrections. The only thing I'm really not seeing is staff being held accountable for assaulting incarcerated individuals. I see incarcerated individuals being held accountable for assault on staff. There are many, many incidences where staff are getting suspensions for 8 hours or more for assaults on incarcerated individuals, individuals that are in restraints. My question is, why are they not being charged? Because if you or I assaulted somebody out here, we would be charged. But yet staff is only getting suspensions. So how are we going to stop this? What additional training can staff receive so that we can stop these incidences? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our last public testimony record we have, James Biardi, you are up and recognized, sir. Good to see you again.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep it brief today. I agree with the Secretary that, you know, everything that you've done, and me and my members, on behalf of the correctional officers, the probation officers, we're very thankful for what you have done. And I agree with the Secretary that the morale is getting better, conditions are getting better. I see firsthand how it is getting better. But we're definitely not out of the woods yet. And any type of setback in the future of the pay raises and the benefits to the officers could put us right back to where we started from. You could build the nicest prisons in the world. You could have the best teachers. You could have the best medical people. If they don't feel safe in that prison, they're not going in. And so my members are working a lot of overtime. And trust me, they rather go home to their families. Every day I get calls. Like, matter of fact, the Secretary, you mentioned Hardy before. I get calls almost every day from the staff at Hardy CI. They're tired, they're overworked, and they need help. And the only help is, I'm sorry to say, is that you have to continue on the path that you have done. You have to fund retention money. And correctional officers over the years, and it's not really any fault of this administration, this governor has been great to us, we love the governor, but in past, that the correction officers and probation officers have left behind of some of the stuff that you give to other law enforcement agencies. There's nowhere else in any other law enforcement agencies where their captains and lieutenants work for free. That happens at the Department of Corrections. After they worked so many hours, they get maxed out, they work past the 40-hour week, and they get no type of compensation for the hours of work. That doesn't happen nowhere. All the other state law enforcement agencies have some type of step or advancement where their pay goes up. Correctional officers don't have that. And some of my best friends, I'm with the Florida Police Benevolent Association. We represent both police and correctional. A lot of them told me, Jimmy, I don't know how you did that for 30 years. I don't know how you did that for 30 years. And my members are willing to do it. We're willing to take the risk. But all they're asking is fairness. And what's good for everybody else, it should be good for the correctional officers. Most of them are hard working. And yes, we're the first to say that, like any other profession, there's probably a few bad out there. That happens to everything else. But every day, correctional officers want to go to work at the prison to defend the, protect the public. And let me tell you something. I say this over and over again. There's a belief that inmates don't like the officers. Well, take the officers out for 24 hours, and you'll see how much the inmates want them back. So I thank everybody for your time. Before you go, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to wish my friend, Ms. Representative Godley, a happy birthday today. It's his birthday. God bless everybody, and please help my members. Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. All right, members, this concludes our committee agenda for today. Is there any other business before the committee? All right. Seeing none, Representative Waldron moves we rise without objection. All right, happy birthday. Representative Gottlieb recommends we rise. This meeting is adjourned. Happy birthday.